All right, so we'll get started with the webinar. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining our distinguished lecture today. I'm Gurdeep Singh. I'm the Division Director for the Computer and Network Systems Division in the SAIS Directorate at NSF. So on behalf of NSF and SAIS, it's my pleasure to welcome you to our distinguished lecture. Before we get started, just wanted to let you know that if you have during the webinar, if you have any questions, please use the Q&A feature to type in your questions, and I will relay those questions. Typically, we hold off on the questions until the webinar presentation is over. Also want to remind everyone that there will be office hours held from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. today for further engagement with our distinguished speaker today. So I would encourage you to join the office hours as well. So with that, I'd like to introduce our speaker today. So our speaker today is Dr. Thomas Marzetta. Dr. Thomas Marzetta is the Distinguished Industry Professor at NYU Tandon School of Engineering, and also the director of NYU Wireless. So he received his electrical engineering PhD in electrical engineering from MIT in 1978, and his MS in systems engineering from UPenn in 1973. So prior to joining NYU in 2017, he had held three industrial careers before, one at Schlumberger, another one at Nichols Research Corporation, and then at Bell Labs. So one of the notable items was that at Bell Labs, he directed the Communication and Statistical Sciences Department, and he was elected the Bell Labs Fellow, and that's when he originated the Massive MIMO, which is one of our cornerstones for the fifth generation wireless technology. So he is the elected member of National Academy of Engineering and also fellow of IEEE. There are numerous other distinctions that he has, and I would invite you to read his full bio for that. So with that, it's my pleasure again to welcome Dr. Marzetta to give our distinguished lecture today. We'll be talking about wireless power transfers, principles, and perspectives. Tom, please take it away.
Okay, thank you, Gurdeep. And I'd like really to thank NSF SAIS for inviting me to this seminar. It's a great honor. So I will talk about wireless power transfer today. And we're going to be really ambitious here and talk about how could one possibly deliver wireless power, say, at a range of 100 meters or so. Before we get into technical things, let me just talk a little bit about NYU Wireless. So NYU Wireless happens to be the largest research center in Tandon School of Engineering. It was started by Ted Rappaport, who is the person here. Ted founded two other academic wireless centers, which are still thriving, one at Virginia Tech, the other at University of Texas at Austin. He's been at NYU for about 8 years. I took over directorship of NYU Wireless 2 years ago. So we have a couple of dozen faculty, 60 students, and we have 15 industrial affiliates. The industrial affiliate members, I'll show you the list in a minute or two, interact with us. They fund our research. It's no strings attached research funding, the best sort. This enables our professors to have some money to do really risky research. And so our mission, pretty clear what it should be. Students are our number one priority. We want to lead the way in future generations of wireless, and we want to be of use to industry. And here our industrial affiliates enable us to keep on top of industrial needs, and also this gives a mechanism for us to transfer research results to industry quickly. So our professors handle all sorts of aspects. I'm one of the more theoretical types. We have Elsa Erkip, an information theorist. At the other end, we have people looking at the upper layers, scheduling and so on of the wireless stack. One of our associate directors is with our medical school, the NYU Medical School, and has an MD and works on some fascinating problems. So we really are well poised to tackle all aspects of wireless. Our efforts are divided among six different research thrusts. My own is in foundations. But Ted Rappaport naturally is moving on to ever higher frequencies. He and his students and Professor Rangan are conducting propagation experiments, both indoors and outdoors, up to above 200 gigahertz these days. We have people working on quantum devices and circuits, interesting applications, how, for instance, to control drones with 5G with the 5G network, for example, with people working in test beds and prototypes, and so it's quite a lot. We have here our 15 affiliates. NSF is sort of at the center, not exactly an affiliate, but in many respects an affiliate. And these represent some of the leading wireless companies in the world. So I was asked to say something, a few personal things about myself. So I'm an East Coast person, was born in 1951 in Washington, D.C. My father was an electrical engineer. He worked at National Bureau of Standards, which renamed itself some years ago NIST. First in his family, going back as far as one wishes to get a college education. He did it the hard way between 1956 and 1963. He attended University of Maryland half-time to get his bachelor's degree in electrical engineering while working full-time at National Bureau of Standards and raising a family, five children. Early on, I learned how to solder. I remember my father helping me build a crystal radio when I was a boy. In those days, we lived about a mile from University of Maryland, and line of sight to the WRC AM radio station tower. So with a loudspeaker and a matching transformer, my crystal radio could easily be heard across the room. I attended, a number of schools. What I'm singling out here is my high school, Gonzaga College High School in Washington. This is at North Capitol Street and I Street, just about 7-8 blocks north of the Capitol. One of the oldest schools in Washington, celebrating its 200th anniversary this year. And why am I talking about it? Because it was by far and away the most competitive school that I ever attended. So after the first year, they grouped students according to perceived abilities. And I wanted to go into the science and mathematics section. Initially, I didn't get in, but my father phoned the headmaster and said, either that boy goes into that group or I'm pulling him out of the school. So that's how I got into this elite group. So we started as 25 students. Took all classes together for 3 years. By the end of the third year, there were fewer than a dozen of us left. And in that group of students, I never ranked more than about sixth. The students were that good and it was that competitive. So when I went to MIT starting in 1968, I thought MIT was easy in comparison. So at MIT, I initially started out as a chemistry major and then switched to physics in my second year, and finally electrical engineering in my third year. The electrical engineering subjects in those days were very well taught at MIT, though there were no labs attached to the regular core classes. So actually, I in comparison to the way earlier engineers were educated, I had probably not as much lab experience as would have been desirable. That's the way education goes. So I had three careers in industry before going to NYU 4 years ago. So Schlumberger Doll Research was a deals with, they still exist. This is in the field of petroleum exploration. At the time, they were building up their research lab in Connecticut. And over a period of 5 years, hired 100 PhDs and also single-handedly pushed up starting salaries for engineers, physicists, chemists, mathematicians, computer scientists, was with very good people. Here, for example, I went in there not knowing how little I knew. So I thought that knowing or having done a PhD in statistical signal processing that I knew something about Fourier transforms. Well, I found it embarrassing a bit to see that wave propagation people, elastic wave propagation, electromagnetic wave propagation, really knew the complex plane much better than I did. I spent 8 years in the defense industry. This was applying traditional statistical pattern recognition techniques to, for example, motion detection in video, discrimination algorithms for ballistic missile defense, radar interpretation, and so on. 1995, until I went to Bell Labs in 1995, I had never worked in communications at all. I had studied it in grad school, but for nearly 20 years hadn't opened up a book on the subject. And I got to Bell Labs by, well, circuitous route. My wife is a PhD computer scientist, Dr. Ingrid Carlbaum. She was recruited by Bell Labs in 1995 to come and head a research department. And I came along and was offered a one-year term position, which lasted for 23 years. So I was fortunate throughout my career to work with people smarter than myself quite often, almost always knowing a lot of things that I didn't know. The other aspect is that this is a bit unconventional because these three areas, petroleum, defense, and telecommunications, are quite different. And so, but that actually worked for me because I've always been able to pull things from one field and use them in another field. So I think I will now go on to the topic at hand, namely wireless power transfer. So everybody's familiar, I mean, wireless power is a fact now, but at extremely short ranges. So electric toothbrush chargers, for example, are wireless. They're inductive. And why would that be so? It's pretty easy to figure out. I mean, if you had electrical contacts, imagine what happens when dried up toothpaste gets on them. They're not going to work very well. And besides, good quality brass, nickel-plated brass contacts are expensive, so it's probably cheaper to go wireless. But what we're interested here is really what can we do on a much bigger scale? And now you can't do this. Nobody's seen a drone flying around operated by wireless power. Operating rooms in hospitals, there are cables all over the places. And factories, one could imagine, what if you could, the robots in a factory, what if they could be completely untethered and didn't have to constantly go back and recharge their batteries? So we don't know how to do this yet, but that's why this is an interesting problem. The good thing is there are no known physical principles standing in the way. We just have to really put the shoulder to the wheel and do some very inventive research. So one's first thought with wireless power transfer is beamforming. And a couple of ways to do this. I could have a dish antenna that focuses power and mechanically steer it, or I could have an electronically steerable phased array. I don't think this is the answer. And let's just do some back of the envelope calculations. So let's suppose my transmitter puts out some power in watts. Now, the transmit antenna has some gain, G sub T. This focuses the power over certain angles. We divide by the area of a sphere of radius R. This gives us the power density in units of watts per meter. There's a standard formula for relating the gain of an antenna to its effective area, radiating area, AT. We do that here. So we have watts per meter. We now multiply watts per meter times the effective area of our receive antenna at our drone. This is the received power. And so we have a very simple formula for the non-dimensional power transfer efficiency. And if we want this efficiency to be in the neighborhood of one, that means, guess what? The geometric mean of the effective areas of my transmit receive antennas has to equal the product of the wavelength and the range at which we want to operate. Let's suppose our drone is 100 meter range. Let's suppose the drone has a receive antenna 10 centimeters on a side. So, so it's not a big drone. And we plug into this formula. And what we're going to do is for three different carrier frequencies, we have the associated wavelengths, and then we have the aperture. A sub T, the transmit aperture in meters needed to do the job. So if we start at 3 gigahertz, this is 10 centimeter wavelength, our transmit antenna has to be, guess what? 100 meters across, which is comparable to the range at which we want to operate. That seems a bit ridiculous. So we jump up a factor of 10 to 30 gigahertz. And now we are 1 centimeter wavelength, okay? Still pretty big aperture, 10 meters on a side. And finally, we go to 300 gigahertz millimeter wave. The aperture is 1 meter on the side. This looks rather favorable, but now think of it. In all cases, our square antenna is 1,000 wavelengths on a side. So if we wanted this to be a phased array, we would have to have, guess what? 4 million antennas, half wavelength antennas, and it's the same irrespective of the carrier frequency. 4 million for this, 4 million for this, and 4 million for this. So maybe it's possible to do something with these classical beamforming techniques, but it doesn't look all that promising. And from a research standpoint, there's not much more that somebody like myself, a communication theorist, can contribute. So we're going to look elsewhere. So in order to understand wireless power, we have to understand how antennas function. And when one learns this in undergraduate engineering school, it looks like a very bewildering subject, because what do they always talk about? A Hertzian dipole, which is an infinitesimally short antenna. Heinrich Hertz, 150 years ago, figured exactly how this antenna functions, what its radiation power is. So then what do they teach you? Well, we actually make the antenna half wavelength long, and we make some assumptions about the current distribution. And for instance, we find that its radiation impedance is, what, 70 ohms or something like that. So this all seems very complicated. And of course, if you really want to find what the current distribution in an actual antenna is, it's a very involved numerical calculation, essentially. And what happens with systems of antennas? How do they interact? So it isn't at all clear. Yet there's a very simple picture, which is circuit theory. So circuit theory of communication, Professor Josef Nozick of TU München did some very fundamental work on this. Here's a couple of other references that you all can look at your leisure. But now, old-fashioned network theory is something that isn't taught too much in engineering schools these days. They were already phasing it out at MIT when I was an undergraduate in the late 1960s. Interestingly enough, one of our emeritus professors, Dante Eula, about 5 years ago, did a very nice book on this topic classical network theory. He's over 90 years old now, and a notable achievement, all right? But when you talk about networks, well, any sort of antenna, a resistor, a capacitor has two wires leading into it. And it's called a ported device because the current going into one of the wires is equal to the current coming out of the other wire. And there's some voltage across these two antennas. The voltage is related to current by a complex impedance. Now I take N antennas or N microphones or N loudspeakers, put them in close proximity, and now I have an N port network. And so it's characterized by N voltages, N currents, and a N by N square impedance matrix. So this is just the relationship between the currents and the voltages, and you can write it out in vector matrix form. For all intents and purposes, unless you really have some man-made structures deliberately designed to behave in a such a unusual way, you have reciprocity, which basically means that this matrix, impedance matrix, is equal to its unconjugated transpose. There aren't too many requirements on this matrix. The real part has to be non-negative definite, because any being a system of passive devices, if I feed any current at all in anywhere into this network, there has to be some positive or non-negative dissipation of power. And that's what we mean here. So before we to talk more about a network of antennas, let's just review an exercise we all went through in undergraduate school. So here I have a voltage source with some internal impedance, ZS. We want to connect this imperfect voltage source with some sort of load impedance. And we want to choose the load impedance to extract as much power as possible from this voltage source. So the classical solution is we directly work with this load impedance. We write out the load power in terms of what? The square of the voltage. Real and imaginary parts, real parts are primed, imaginary parts are double primed, of the source impedance and load impedance. And guess what? The optimum load impedance should be the complex conjugate of the internal impedance of the voltage source. And this is the expression we get for the maximum possible power. Now we're going to have to do a similar exercise with these networks of antennas, but I don't want to do an optimization over an impedance matrix. Instead, I can actually do all optimizations over vectors of current. So instead of optimizing over a square matrix, I'm just going to optimize over a current vector. And so we can use the same trick here. So we forget about this impedance, and what we do is we focus on the load current. And what we're going to do is adjust the load current so that we pull the maximum power out. This might, you might think that, gosh, we're going to be cheating or laying ourselves open to cheating if we can arbitrarily set this load current to be anything we want. But if we actually make this load current too great, it turns out we're going to be feeding power back into the voltage source. So again, we forget about the impedance entirely, the load impedance, work only with the load current, and we get the same result. This is a really useful trick. I'm not saying I invented it, but like so many things, one didn't learn it in school, and it's tough to find in the literature. So now let's consider the problem at hand, power transfer between two arrays of antennas, or this could be an acoustic problem, two arrays of microphones or loudspeakers. So here we have a transmit array with M antennas described by a current vector and a voltage vector. And we have a receive array described by a current vector I and a voltage vector V. And the voltages are related to the currents through a partitioned impedance matrix. So what we're doing here is what we want to do here is get rid of the voltages and simply write out the transmitted power in terms of the transmit current and the receive current. We want to write out the receive power in terms of the transmit current and receive current. So we start, of course, with the voltages. So the transmit power, we simply take each antenna and multiply the voltage appearing on that antenna by the conjugate of the current going into that antenna. And we sum up over all the antennas and take the real part. Well, we can get this voltage from this impedance relation. So we can eliminate voltage, and this is what we get. So this is our transmitted power in terms of IM, the transmitted power or current vector, and IN, the received current vector. Sorry, received power, it's just the opposite sign, because a current, by convention, current is still going into the antenna. We want to take the current coming out of the antenna, hence a minus sign. So we have a very similar expression for received power. Now we're just going to take the ratio of received power to transmit power. That's the power transfer efficiency. So here's our expression. And now we're going to, we're now perfectly free to choose the transmit currents IM, the receive currents IN. It's pretty clear that if we just uniformly double everything, transmit receive currents, we have exactly the same efficiency as before. Nothing changes. Well, two strategies come to mind. One is, call it a greedy strategy, which is not really a non-cooperative strategy. So whatever current is being transmitted, IM, the receiver essentially tries to draw as much power as possible out of its system of antennas. Doesn't care what cost this is, of course, to the transmit antenna. It's just going after optimum power. So pretty easy to get the this greedy receive current in terms of transmit current and resubstitute into our efficiency. Now we've eliminated the receive current. All we have is an expression of transmit current, which we can optimize over. What happens? Well, our efficiency will never exceed 50% if we use this greedy strategy. It's a bit like the trying to classical problem of pulling maximum power out of a voltage source having an internal impedance. Now, if instead we jointly, cooperatively optimize the transfer efficiency over both the transmit currents and the receive currents, we have a completely different problem, and we're not restricted by this maximum 50% efficiency. And all of these optimization problems, by the way, are generalized eigenvector, eigenvalue problems. Let's go back to the previous, let's go back to this classical problem of the voltage source here. What to get around, how to get around this? Well, it seems to have been Thomas Edison who realized, and in fact, until the time of Thomas Edison, it was customary to try to pull as much power as you could out of an electrical generator. And this meant making the load resistance equal to the internal resistance of the generator, 50% efficient. Edison came along to design, working on his electric power distribution and lighting system, and said, why should we do this? Why not make the load impedance much bigger than the internal impedance of the generator? He did that, and of course, with other refinements in generators, he made generators 10, 100 times bigger than they'd ever been made before, with efficiencies above 80%, 80, 85% one reads. And so this, there's some moral lessons in this, or philosophical lessons. I want to talk a little bit about this later, but all of this, of course, was governed by Ohm's law, voltage equals current times resistance, and Joule's law, power equals voltage times current. And at the time, anybody, any good who worked with electricity in those days, this was in late 1870s, knew these two laws. The fact is, the most brilliant physicists in the world at the time didn't realize the implications of Ohm's law and Joule's law. So we tend to think Edison's work was inventing the light bulb. That was only one part of it. He himself called it, guess what, subdividing the electric current. In other words, generation of electrical power and distribution was almost the biggest thing that he did. And I could talk all day on Edison, but let's, the point is, knowing the mathematics behind a problem doesn't mean you really understand the problem. Okay, that's the philosophical lesson. So we have our strategies, all right? Now let's go to the special case where we have a transmit array with M antennas and we're sending to us power to a single antenna terminal. By the way, it turns out that when you optimize the efficiency is the same in both directions, whether I'm transmitting from this array to this terminal or from this terminal to this array. In any case, for this case, you can get a closed form expression for the optimum transfer efficiency in terms of this auxiliary parameter alpha, which in turn can be expressed in terms of elements of the impedance matrix. And smaller a alpha is, the better off we are. Alpha is always greater than or equal to one. So the closer alpha is to one, the closer our efficiency is to one. And if we have perfect coupling between the transmit array and this receiver, then we get 100% efficiency. Now our greedy strategy, remember that was whatever the transmitter does, the receiver tries to pull maximum power out of its antenna. This has an even simpler expression for the efficiency. Alpha is always greater than or equal to one, so the greedy efficiency is never greater than 1/2. And so what I've done in this graph is just plot out the blue curve, which is maximized efficiency as a function of this parameter alpha. And the dotted red is simply the greedy efficiency, which stops at 1/2, whereas for small enough alpha, the maximized efficiency can go as high as you wish, with difficulty, of course. All right, so this really completes our discussion of the circuit theory of wireless power transfer. And in a sense, you see, there's nothing more to say about this. We've got this expression. This is universally applicable to any system of antennas. There's nothing more to say about the problem. The function of electromagnetic theory viewed from this narrow point of view is simply to provide us with numerical values to fill in the impedance matrix so that we can figure out how well we can do. This, of course, is a gross simplification, but we need to now go to some electromagnetic theory to understand what's going on. We previously pointed out that conventional beamforming, just conventional phased array activities, are unlikely to solve the long-range electrical wireless power transfer problem. So, what's of particular interest to me is a topic called superdirectivity. This was originated by a Bell Labs researcher in 1943, Sergei Shelkhanov. Now, Shelkhanov is also famous for having developed coaxial cable in the 1930s, and provocative title. I learned about this in 1995. Incidentally, Jerry Foschini, of course, is very famous for his pioneering contributions to multiple antenna wireless. On my first day at Bell Labs in 1995, I met Jerry and he told me about his MIMO work, and I thought, this is the supreme invention. I'm at the right place. He and Mike Gans wrote an internal memo in 1995. There was an appendix in it which didn't make it into the published version of the paper, but let me just read what, and the appendix was written entirely by Mike Gans, who was an expert in electromagnetic theory. So what are they saying here? We have a transmitting horn antenna, low gain, located in outer space, aimed at Earth. Has a huge, maybe a 45 degree beam width. Okay, get this. In principle, a one wavelength diameter super gain, they're using the term super gain here, not super directivity, but that's the same idea. It's possible for that receive array to receive virtually all of the power radiated by the horn antenna. So that's super directivity. And this seems very weird. Among other things, of course, we know we have to have conservation of energy. So this receive array can't pull more power out of the ether than the transmit antenna is radiating. What happens, for instance, if you have other receive antennas around? Are they affected by this? It's not at all obvious, and it wasn't so obvious to me in those days. But now I want to try to impart my understanding of this topic. So to make matters even more confusing, superdirectivity is sometimes confused with another phenomenon called superresolution. Well, the chief distinction is superdirectivity is a physical thing, and the idea is actually to put antennas in a transmit array close enough together so that they interact. Strong mutual coupling. Now, ordinarily, we communication theorists love to think that antennas in an array are uncoupled. Makes life very easy and simple, but they in fact are, and in particular, if they're made close together. All right, the super resolution method is just a mathematical thing. The whole idea is that you have samples from an antenna array, say a linear array of finite length, and you know that classically the angular resolution is equal to the wavelength divided by the linear aperture of the array, non-dimensional quantity. And longer the array, the finer the beam. Well, the whole idea of super resolution is you pretend that the propagating field is spatially band limited, Nyquist interval, a half wavelength. Now, in fact, it really isn't, because you have evanescent waves in the near field that actually go faster than that implied rate, which is 2 pi over lambda. But if it really were mathematically a band-limited field, then it's what's called an analytic function. And in fact, by measuring this field over a finite interval, I could in fact extrapolate the field in both directions as far away as I wanted. So in effect, starting with measurements from a small array, I could mathematically extrapolate and infer what I would measure if I had a really large array, which would have much finer angular resolution. Superdirectivity, however, relies on a physical effect, mutual coupling among antennas. And in fact, if I were doing synthetic aperture radar, I could in principle use super resolution, but not superdirectivity. So these are distinct things. So let me just give an example of a super directive scenario. So here I have a linear array of m elements spaced evenly d apart. And on the axis of the array, hence end fire, I have a receive antenna. All right, so this whole system is described by a partitioned impedance matrix. And here is the M by M impedance matrix that describes the mutual coupling among the transmit antennas. We're only interested in its real part. And here is the propagation vector ZM1 between the M antennas and the single receiver. And then the self-impedance of each antenna is just one. And what we want to do is we have a power, total power, transmitted power constraint. Subject to that constraint, we want to maximize the open circuit voltage on the receive antenna. So here we're not trying to transmit power, we're just trying to transmit or impart the biggest signal to the receive antenna. If you ignore mutual coupling, everybody knows this is like a matched filter. It's called maximum ratio beamforming. Underwater acoustics people call it time reversal beamforming. And in fact, my optimum transmit current is just the conjugate of the propagation vector normalized to get the power to conform to our transmitted power constraint. So what this gives us is an open circuit voltage who's on the receive antenna, whose square is just proportional to M, the number of transmit antennas. So this is the usual beamforming gain for normal activities. Superdirective beamforming, well, we have to actually take into account the interaction among the transmit antennas. So instead of some of the currents being equal to P0, instead we have this quadratic form in the in terms of the real part of the this M by M impedance matrix. And so this looks like a colored noise matched filter type of problem. It's mathematically the same. Guess what? For this configuration, we get a beamforming gain that's proportional to M squared instead of M. So basically, super directivity increases, in this example, beamforming gain from M to M squared. Not so obvious this happens. Let's just see numerically. So we have an 8-element array. Okay, and what we're plotting here is the maximum ratio beamforming gain, the dashed curve, as a function of the antenna spacing and wavelengths, and then the solid curve is the superdirective antenna gain. We start at half wavelength, and both are equally good, giving a beamforming gain of 8, which is the number of antennas. We decrease the antenna spacing. Maximum ratio does a little bit better for a while and then heads south. And by the time we're here, guess what? These eight antennas are almost on top of one another and doing no better than a single antenna. So here, maximum ratio is giving a beamforming gain of 1. It's as if we had only one antenna, whereas super directive array is giving M squared almost 64. So let's look at another scenario. So again, we have a linear array, but now the receiver is broadside to the array, normal to the array axis. So here we have on the, I think on the line XY equals 0, we have our array on the Z axis, and then the receiver is now normal to the array, normal to this line. Guess what? We get absolutely no super directivity whatsoever. Decreasing spacing between antennas just makes things head south. We did this for 2 up to 32 antennas. So what's going on here? How do we explain super directivity? Well, in the limit, as these as the spacing goes to 0, these 8 antennas are almost on top of one another. How should we utilize them? Well, just consider 2 antennas. If we move 2 antennas very close together, what can we do? Well, we can always express the 2 currents in terms of the sum of the 2 currents and the difference of the 2 currents. The sum itself, you know, we may want to use it, but that doesn't do anything that a single antenna can't do. But the difference of the currents, if we make the magnitude of the currents, make the 2 currents equal and opposite with a magnitude inversely proportional to the spacing, then it's like a spatial derivative. And in fact, we can think of a short dipole as equivalent to a 2-element superdirective array. Because what is a short dipole? We have 2 sources of charge, equal and opposite in sign, that are very close together, and their magnitudes are inversely proportional to the spacing. That's just a Hertzian dipole. So if our current distribution as a function of z is the position along the axis of the array, in the limit, when the antennas are on top of each other, is just a superposition, a linear combination of spatial derivatives of a point source of a Dirac delta function. So we're doing funny things here. It's also telling us that, guess what? The closer we make the antennas to super directivity, we're actually feeding numerically bigger and bigger currents into the antennas. So let's give 2 interpretations. Mathematical, what's the mathematical interpretation? You look at this real part of the mutual impedance matrix among my transmit antennas. Look at the eigenspace, find a subspace of the eigenspace that has very small eigenvalues. Those modes you can drive with very large, numerically large currents without expending much real power. That seems like a good thing. At the same time, we want this eigenspace to contain at least some of the energy of the propagation vector. So if we can do this, then we can get super directivity. So it's really just a eigenvector eigenvalue explanation. There's a physical explanation, though. So it was shown in 1919 by the mathematician Hermann Weyl, who his career, I think, culminated at Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. But in 1919, Weil showed that a spherical wave due to a point source externally can be expanded in terms of plane waves, a superposition of plane waves. Not at all obvious result. And by extension, any distribution of sources in some finite volume, so in this case, our M element antenna array, externally, we can represent the total field due to these M antennas as a superposition of plane waves. Well, in the Z direction, we're creating very large currents that vary rapidly over Z. So the wave number, the spatial frequency associated with the radiating field, or at least some parts of the radiating field, has a wave number greater than K, K being 2 pi over lambda, the inherent propagation constant for the medium. Now, the sum of squares of wave numbers has to add up to K squared. This means that transversely, the X and Y wave numbers have to have a square which is negative. So these become imaginary valued. Well, if a wave number in a plane wave is imaginary valued, then the plane wave decays exponentially fast in that direction and carries only reactive power. So this explains why we're able to get this extra gain in the Z direction. Our external field is made up in part of these super wave number plane waves. These super plane wave number plane waves don't radiate transversely. So it's a bit like squeezing a tube of toothpaste. It shoots out the end in the Z direction. Okay, this explains also why that broadside operation example that we showed here didn't display any superdirectivity, because in the direction we wanted to go, putting the antennas close together was creating evanescent waves, which were decaying exponentially fast towards the receiver and carrying in part only reactive power. So this is what's going on, two interpretations. Let's consider just a simple power transfer example. So now we have a 10 element antenna array, linear array. Again, this is end-fire operation. Our receiver is 5 wavelengths from, I believe, the center of the antenna array. And now what we're doing here is we did our super directive calculation, but we assumed that the transmit antennas had some internal ohmic resistance, and that the ratio of the ohmic resistance to the radiation resistance was variously 1, 10 to the minus 2, all the way to 10 to the minus 12. So 10 to the minus 12 basically means that there's no internal resistance within my transmit antennas. That could actually be achieved in theory with superconducting transmit antennas. And what we've done again is plotted out the power transfer efficiency, okay, as a function of the antenna spacing for these 7 cases. And we start at half wavelength, and well, we see that basically for each one of these specified internal radiation or internal ohmic resistance, there's some optimum spacing beyond which making the spacing shorter makes, of course, the efficiency decrease. And by the time we're up here, we're basically getting about 5 times the transfer efficiency that we got when we had half wavelength spacing. So this is a toy example, but it does illustrate some points. So traditional problems with superdirectivity, this was known even by Shalkanov. So as I said, as the antennas get closer together, we're trying to create spatial derivatives effectively, meaning that the currents we drive these antennas with grow essentially without bound. And this is associated with the fact that our real part of our impedance matrix is becoming near singular as the spacing shortens. Okay. This, of course, should set some alarm bells off. It does. In fact, when I was doing this calculation, MATLAB wouldn't let me go to any shorter spacing. And I tried, of course, we're dealing with a Toeplitz matrix. I tried all of the fancy Toeplitz matrix algorithms, Schur algorithm, and so on that were developed 30, 40 years ago. None of them did as well as Cholesky factorization. So what's the other problem? Well, again, these antenna currents are becoming enormous. Our real radiated power is under control, but the reactive power is huge. And the huge currents also are responsible for internal ohmic losses, unless, of course, we have superconducting antennas. And we have a huge reactive field in the vicinity of the antenna array. Is that so bad? Every quarter cycle, you feed reactive power out into the ether. The next quarter cycle, it's pulled back into the antennas. But of course, at some point, the electric field intensity might get so great that the air is ionized. And of course, with any sort of problem with dividing by a matrix that's nearly singular, you have some extreme sensitivity issues that need dealing with. Okay. With all that, the question then is, can we make super directivity practical? So I've mentioned superconducting antennas, possibly metamaterials, new MIMO configurations. So if people are talking about various forms of MIMO, holographic MIMO, intelligent reflecting surfaces, another variation basically surrounds the user or users with antenna arrays. So if I'm inside of an office room, I could conceivably have the floor, ceiling, and walls covered with conformal antenna arrays. So, or if I'm in a New York City, there's this canyon of skyscrapers, I'm surrounded on all four sides effectively. So if you think about it, all of our experience with wireless, or most of it, wireless communications, it's the opposite. We have antenna array, things are going outwards. But here, the antenna arrays surround the users, and so it's a totally different configuration. I'm not sure we really understand that very well. We want robots in a factory. What if you made this factory with copper walls, ceiling, and floors? So this is now totally different from free space propagation. It's a highly reverberant propagation environment. It has some advantage. Interior is isolated from exterior, so there should be no spectrum licensing issues. As long as this is a solid copper box, nothing's going to radiate outside. I don't have to pay any attention to spectrum licensing. Because there are no near-far effects, so 1 over R attenuation doesn't really work. If I send out a source and expand it in plane waves, each plane wave flies all over the place and creates plane waves from all sorts of angles, so there's many degrees of freedom. And now just consider, supposing I put two antennas, simple antennas, a transmit and a receive antenna in this box. Let's suppose neither antenna has any internal resistance, then without doing any super directive stuff, I have 100% power transfer efficiency between these two antennas. So there are possibly other things. So let's go back to this philosophical issue about mathematics and what does it really count for? Obviously, it's a tool we use and must use. But here's a great example from the year 2008. A group of professors and students at MIT did this experiment. They had this transmit coil, which was driven by 10 megahertz continuous wave signal. Over here, a similar coil, and see, it's lighting up a light bulb. This is several meters. The wavelength is 30 meters, so we're operating about less than a tenth of a wavelength receiver from transmitter. the world was surprised that they were able to transmit 60 watts of power with 40% efficiency. And this system of coils is basically nothing but an open, an air core transformer. Well, an ordinary iron transformer is designed so that the coupling coefficient between, which is the percentage of magnetic flux generated by the transmit coil or primary coil that's intercepted by the secondary coil is like 99%. Here, the coupling coefficient was 0.2%. And so how were they able to get such efficiency? Well, it turns out that the Q is the ratio of the reactance of the primary coil to its resistance. That's QP, and similarly for the receiver, QS. Both these Qs were about 1,000. And if you look at this formula, yes, you take square root of 1,000 times 1,000 times 0.002, and guess what? You get 2, the number 2, and when you substitute in here and square it and so on, yeah, you get 40% efficiency. So they published this in Annals of Physics, which was the journal that Einstein published his most famous papers. And as I say, the world was surprised. Why should the world have been surprised? After all, somebody 100, 120 years ago had thoroughly worked out all of the mathematics for this problem, fully understood. So the mathematics was in place, but people really didn't understand its implications. So once again, just because we have the mathematics for a problem, that doesn't close the door on innovation and invention. And by the way, if you look at this expression for efficiency, which is equivalent to the one that I presented earlier in the talk, if I let the primary Q go to infinity, but the secondary Q not, guess what? My efficiency goes to 1. This means that if you believe this expression, and of course there are some caveats, if I make the primary coil superconducting, I should get close to 100% transfer efficiency. Okay. So a final thing I want to simply, you need to know electromagnetic theory if you're going to, or at least have a working knowledge of it, if you're going to contribute to these topics in wireless power transfer. And of course, all of us, all electrical engineers have been exposed to this in undergraduate school. But it's of course a fact of life that most communication theorists, even wireless communication theorists, most signal processing researchers really are not comfortable with electromagnetic theory. And I think there's a better way to teach it than the way all of us were taught this subject. So this spring, I've been giving a new course, a linear system approach to wave propagation. Let me, I hope I don't scare too many people by these old formulas or bringing back old nightmares. But look, here's the traditional physicist's approach. So electromagnetic field comprises an electric field, 3-component vector magnetic field, okay? We produce this by a transmitter. In this case, we model our system of transmitters just as a electric current density source expressed in amps per meter square. This is distributed in time and space. Here are the four Maxwell's equations driven by the electric current density. What does a physicist do? Physicist expresses the E and H fields in terms of a scalar potential phi, a vector potential A. These unintuitive, really non-physical relations. And an extra condition on the vector potential. And you substitute these expressions into Maxwell's equations and simplify, and you find you get four uncoupled wave equations driven by the electric current density. A physicist likes to solve the wave equation by method of separation of variables and often in spherical coordinates, which spherical coordinates have their uses. But if you want to figure what does a linear array or a or a planar array on a Cartesian grid, how does that affect the electric and magnetic field? You lose all insight and signal processing insight by working in spherical coordinates. I don't like them, though they're you need them for some things. So what's my approach? Maxwell's equations. But now, the thing to notice is Maxwell's equations can be interpreted as descriptive of a linear space-time invariant system. What do we mean? Well, we have an input to the system, which is this electric current density, and we have an output, which is the E and H fields. Okay, if we compute E and H in terms of a particular J, now if we delay this source in time by 10 seconds, we get the same solution for electric and magnetic fields delayed by 10 seconds. If I move this source, 20 meters north-northeast, then guess what? I get the same solution with the E and H fields shifted by the same amount in space. So this means we can, however complicated it is, we can express the solution for E and H fields as a space-time convolution in terms of this impulse response, which is a 6x3 matrix, and technically it's called a Green's function, but you can just think impulse response. Well, if this is a convolution in space and time, it's a multiplication in temporal frequency and spatial frequency. And so how do we find this space, the temporal spatial frequency response of the system? We simply take four-dimensional Fourier transform, space-time Fourier transform of both sides of Maxwell's equations. And we do that, and now we're entirely in the frequency wave number domain. We have, let's see, 3 and 3 is 6 unknowns. We have 7 unknowns, and we have 8 equations here. And 15 minutes of time, you can actually get an explicit closed form solution for the E and H fields in terms of the transform of the electric current density. This is closed form, no approximation. And now the thing to focus on is all of the wave propagation action is in this denominator. And guess what? Suppose we just hold temporal frequency and kx and ky fixed and just consider this as a linear shift invariant system with transform kz. We can factor this denominator polynomial into two simple poles. We extract the residues of the poles, and with some work, we actually get a very fundamental result that the source distribution is confined to some compact volume region in space. And exterior to the source distribution, I can rigorously expand the electric and magnetic fields, E and H, in terms of plane waves of this form. And the sum of the squares of the three wave numbers has to add up to k squared, k being 2 pi over lambda. Okay, so enough of this course. I think I've given you a bit of a flavor for how this can be done. And it really makes life infinitely easier and more insightful for both the signal processing researcher and the communication theorist. I'm running over by about 5 minutes, but this is the last slide. And I think my conclusions probably are pretty obvious. There's just an enormous potential impact for wireless power transfer, but we don't know yet how to transmit power wirelessly 100 meters or more. We've got to have more bold and risky research. It has to be both bold and has to be risky, okay? This isn't going to happen on its own, unless, of course, we have some a lone inventor or inventor getting some tremendous intuitive insight and actually producing some prototype that can transmit wireless power 100 meters. It isn't impossible, but as researchers, of course, we operate in a different way. A lot of our people really could stand to acquire a real working knowledge of electromagnetic theory, and I think there's a better way than the way we learned it, or I think virtually all of us learned it in school. And then this philosophical issue that you can have a complete mathematical description of a topic or a phenomenon, but that doesn't mean you really understand the phenomenon. And so there's still scope for discovery and invention. And then just a final a piece of wisdom from Lord Kelvin back in the 1870s. So I'm going to stop here and I'd like to take some questions. And again, sorry for running over a little bit.
Thank you, Dr. Marzetta. Thank you for that excellent lecture, you know, providing us with the theoretical background, how research in this area has progressed through the years, and then your thoughts on, you know, what needs to be done to make it practical. So thank you. It's a great presentation. So I would invite our participants to use the Q&A feature to pose the questions there. So there are some of them. So I'll start off with the first one. So you have talked about, you know, the how to make wireless transfer practical. So this is a question from George Markonski. So what can you say about wireless power technology that Tesla has developed or talked about?
Right. So Tesla, of course, famously talked about wireless power, did some demos of it. I honestly can't say too much because my understanding is that his lab burned down disastrously at some point late in his career, and his notes were lost, and he didn't publish papers for the most part. So precisely what he did, I'm not equipped to say. So he probably would not have been surprised at all by the experiment that the group at MIT did in 2008, and in fact may well have done similar experiments.
Thank you. So next question is from Lisa Close. So we talked about, you know, when you are looking at wireless transfer, the medium is air. So what happens when we switch the fluid from air to water?
That's a real good question. Of course, underwater work is exceedingly difficult because to do underwater sonar or underwater acoustic communications, you can't ignore the details of the wave propagation because the ocean is not a uniform medium. You have basically sound speed and density are affected strongly by salinity and temperature. And so there, you will always have to take into account the inhomogeneities or at least the stratified layering. If you try to do wireless power transfer underwater, one of the limitations you run against is that in shallow water, if you make the sound intensity too strong, the dynamic pressure magnitude exceeds the hydrostatic pressure at the depth at which you're working. Total pressure goes negative. And if you have a, unless your fluid is absolutely pure with no dissolved dirt particles or air, a fluid generally cannot support negative pressure. It tears apart, cavitates. So this, in fact, so that's one difficulty with underwater wireless power transfer.
Next question I have is from Shankar Basu. So I'll read the question to you. So it says, you have generalized the circuit theoretic problem of broadband matching of Herbert Carlin and D'Angiola to passive multiports in the context of antennas. The question is, what about the inverse circuit antenna synthesis problem? That is, how can one design the antenna array from specifications? Can one draw classical multiport circuit synthesis theory, such as the old classical papers from Onan Yesaru on multiport passive circuit synthesis?
That's a good question. So So remember how I formulated transmitting power from one array to another array. I basically formulated in terms of the transmit current vector and the receive current vector, and did my power efficiency optimization jointly over the two vectors of currents. Now, and so I paid no attention to the load impedances or impedance network that one tacks on to the receive antennas. Yet, of course, to make a functioning power transfer system, I would have to do that. So I would have to take my N receive antennas, and I'd have to connect them to a passive linear network of resistors. I'm sorry, no, you don't want resistors, they're going to dissipate power. Capacitors, inductors, and transformers. And so there's a whole science, this would be in Eula's book, and of course in classical books by Ernst Gilman from 60 years ago or more, that tell you how you could actually synthesize a passive network to have some desired impedance versus frequency or transfer characteristics. So the answer is yes, you would have to draw on a lot of this classical network synthesis theory to build a practical wireless transfer system.
Thank you. So this question is by Kuan Yan Zhu. So he asked, would feedback control be useful to increase the power transfer efficiency?
That's a great question. If the both ends of the link, the transmitter and the receiver, if they both know the complete impedance matrix, you know, with 100% accuracy, then feedback control is not going to help any, because you can just open loop set the transmit and receive currents. All right, practically speaking, of course, and remember I said that if you want to do super directivity, it's a very sensitive, that is the optimum currents are very sensitive to the assumed impedance matrix. Yeah, then some sort of feedback scheme could help. So roughly speaking, and I haven't spent any time looking at this problem, you have a CSI acquisition problem of two types, CSI standing for channel state information. Namely, you need to know all elements of this impedance matrix. So in addition to putting pilot signals into each of the transmit antennas and measuring the received signal at the other antennas, to get between the transmit array and receive array, you need to do it internally in the transmit array in order to infer the mutual coupling among the antennas. Next question, please.
Thank you. Next question. So this is from Bertrand Hochwald. So he's asking, was the MIT experiment an example of super directivity or inductive mutual coupling, or is it the same thing?
Good question. I don't think of it as an example of super directivity. It was inductive mutual coupling. If you look at one of the papers from this MIT group, they called it resonant evanescent wave coupling. And so, you know, one way to analyze their system was to just as I did in the view graph, you draw a circuit diagram, and this is a air core transformer. But you can do a full Maxwell's equation approach of this as well. In the end, you should get the same answer. And remember, I said that whatever I do in a transmit region externally, the field is expandable in plane waves. So this transmit coil, once I get away from that coil, I have a superposition of plane waves. Now, this is extreme near field, so most of these plane waves, the strongest ones, are evanescent waves. And so what's going towards the receive coil is a bunch of evanescent waves that are decaying exponentially fast towards the receive coil and nominally carry only reactive power toward the receive coil, but we're somehow frustrating them, making them, these evanescent waves, do something contrary to their nature by transmitting power. Okay, next question, please.
Thank you. So the next question is from Song Feng. He's asked, what do you think about simultaneous wire transfer and power transfer?
Ah, that's a very good question. I mean, potentially you can do that, but let's try to think a little bit about this. So super directivity could be used for wireless communications. Of course, we're talking about sending, say, milliwatts or tens of milliwatts via wireless power, maybe a nanowatt or a picowatt for communication purposes. So there's, you know, you're really talking about nine orders of magnitude of power that you're trying to transfer. Another issue is that nobody would ever use super directivity for communications purposes without first exhausting other measures. So you're obviously going to be using as much spectrum as you can, 10 or 20 megahertz. All right. So any super directive stuff that you want to do for communication purposes, you've got to do over very broad band. And that's a very difficult problem because, again, if you're going to design these passive networks, you have to do clever things. Now there's a strong frequency dependence. And so it's a very difficult design problem. In a sense, then wireless power transfer is an easier problem because we can make it happen just at a single frequency. So next question, please.
Thank you. The next one is a comment by Rita Rodriguez about, you know, that there is a group in Northeastern NEU which works on underwater communications. And my next question is from Adam Zerwa. So it says, should wireless transmission technology be made more efficient and practical for broad energy use? And if so, would such new technology require all electrical technologies like generators, motors, transformers to be redesigned to at least some degree?
Oh, a good question. First of all, the previous comment, yes, I know that underwater acoustics group at Northeastern, they're really good people. In fact, it turns out that at MIT, my PhD advisor was Arthur Bagerer, who started out purely, and he was a student of Harry Van Trees, so he started out in detection and estimation. But then over the years, he went into underwater acoustics. And so and at any rate, yes, so let's see. I'm not sure you would have to change the generators, motors, and transformers. I mean, let's face it, copper wires can carry enormous amounts of power relatively easily. And of course, by using very high voltages and comparatively low currents, you get minimize your ohmic losses. So I don't think we want to abandon that any more than we would want to abandon optical fiber where we can afford to use it. So just as mobile wireless communications, yes, we need it where we need it. Similarly, if we can make wireless power work at long range, we'll use it where we need to use it. Things like flying drones around, or when we want to have hundreds of robots in a factory that are untethered. Next question, please.
So next question is by Hitesh Podar. Do you feel that going forward to 6G small cell deployments, is there ever going to be a possibility of our base station to change our UE and deliver data at the same rate?
Let's see, I'm reading the question now. Do you feel that going forward to 6G with, say, small cell deployments, is there ever going to be a possibility for base stations to charge? Oh, so you want the base station to charge the UE and to handle data at the same time. That's an interesting thought. I suppose conceivably you could do it, but again, I would tend to think that you would want to have a separate array at the base station, one for transmitting power, the other for communications purposes.
Thank you. Next question is by Deep Mehdi. So he says, where do you see as the next step in the most innovations needed in this space? So you talked about risky research, and you talked about even education. So talk maybe both from the research and the education side.
So innovation needed in the space. I think the best thing is, of course, to get some multidisciplinary attention and thinking. My experience over the years is there are a lot of people who really understand wave propagation very well, people who can build microwave equipment incredibly skillfully and make it work and do what they want it to do. Such people, however, with some a few exceptions, but mostly most such people do not understand communication theory, do not understand Shannon theory. Conversely, yes, here and there you'll find a communication theorist or an information theorist who understands wave propagation, but most don't. And so we're really missing out because, and in fact, I get the impression that when actual commercial, let's say 5G, 6G wireless equipment is built, that it's sort of divided up between two parties. You have the RF people who worry about the RF electronics, power amplifiers, cables, antennas, that's mixers, that sort of thing. And then you have the people who design the modulation schemes, the channel coding, that sort of thing. And it's as if these, yes, of course, these two groups have to interact to some extent, but at some level they don't. They proceed oblivious of the expertise that the other side has.
Thank you. So this is a follow-up from Rita Rodriguez to her comments on the underwater communications. So what do you think about trying to open underwater centers for communication?
Well, I think that that's a very good example of, I think that there could be great benefits if more electromagnetic wireless communications people talk to underwater acoustics people, because both sides, again, would benefit from such a discussion. It's, I mean, among other things, you can have underwater acoustic situations where channels are doubly spread, for example. They're not really time invariant systems. They change rapidly over time. And, we're not used to dealing with such things in most electromagnetics communications. We like to assume that the channel is fixed long enough so we can estimate it. But a true time varying system by its nature is not even identifiable, because if I send a training signal through it, yes, I learn what it was in the past, but 5 seconds later, five hours later, it may have changed. So I think that there, again, some cross disciplinary mixing and willingness to learn something about other fields can really help us all.
So Nick Lindman asks, are you writing a book or maybe sharing your lecture notes for your new course?
Okay, I'm planning to start writing the book this summer. So that's the short answer. And let's hope that I actually can do some fairly fast writing. Once again, my aim in that book would be a relatively thin book, no more than 150 pages. But that was the way that I did my book with my comrades, Eric Larson, Hong Yang, Heen Kwok No. We set out to write a short book to completely get across the concept of massive MIMO and to try to teach everything as simply as possible. So I'll try for that in this new book. Thank you.
Thank you. Finally, there's a comment, follow-up comment by Shankar Basu. So he says, fluid mechanics is inherently nonlinear, so underwater communication is a different game. So
Well, at ordinary sound pressure levels, that's correct. But yes, if you're starting to, if the fluid is starting to cavitate, then that's a tricky business, right?
Okay. I guess we have no more questions in the chat box right now. So, and we are almost coming to the end of the scheduled time. So want to thank you, Dr. Marzatta, for your excellent presentation and also for the engaging Q&A and so sharing your thoughts with us. So thank you once again.
Well, thank you, everyone, and thank you for the great questions. And so I understand that this meeting at, what is it, 3 p.m. is
3 p.m.
open to everyone. So I hope some of you show up with some even more questions. Thank you again.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you to all of those who joined. And as Dr. Marzatta said, I would encourage you to join at 3 p.m. for any other questions and discussions you may want. Thank you, everyone.